In the 1950s and early 1960s, the situation for women in Australia was grim. They often earned only half as much as men. Women working in the public service or armed forces were required to quit if they married. Home-based childcare was the norm. Domestic violence within marriage was legal. Divorce was difficult. Contraception was illegal and highly taxed. And abortion was illegal. But women began to organise and fight back. By 1969, the Women's Liberation Movement was starting to organise. Now, this resistance didn't take place in a political vacuum. The women's movement grew at a time of massive worker militancy, and it took its place alongside other new social movements against the war in Vietnam and for Indigenous rights, for gay and lesbian rights, and for environmental action. It's a period rich with lessons for activists today. Today I'm talking about this militant tradition with Judy McVeigh. Judy is a socialist who's been involved in fighting for women's liberation since the 1970s. She's the author of the recent Solidarity pamphlet, Abortion, The Fight That's Still to Be Won. And she's currently researching the struggles of workers and women in the 1960s and 1970s in Australia. You're listening to The Sound of Solidarity, brought to you by Solidarity. We're a revolutionary socialist group in Australia, and if you'd like to find out more about us, our website is solidarity.net.au. I'm David Glanz, and I'm recording this episode on unceded Wurundjeri land in Naam, or Melbourne. Judy, welcome.
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me.
Now, you've written that the catalyst for the new social movements, including the women's movement, was, quote, rising expectations hitting against a wall of ideological conservatism. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Yeah, well, just imagine, after the Second World War, years of economic depression of the 30s and World War of the 40s took Australia closest that it had ever been to a major war. But soon, what followed was the longest boom in history. So expectations for a better life grew through the 50s and 60s. Labour shortages caused federal government to introduce immigration for workers beyond the usual white British sources to particularly Greek, Italian and East Europeans. There was an economic boom that was accompanied by new technology, the need for services and more state bureaucracy. In this situation, there was an instability in the economy and changing circumstances, new industries needing these new workers, more education, opening up across the world, new influences. And there were cultural changes, particularly young people were drawn into the new music, the blues music, rock and roll. They had more money. Yet at the same time, the Australian government engaged in holding things back. It was a one-sided boom as wages did not keep up. Like today, wages were stagnating, poverty reached record levels during the 50s. And ideas were stagnating as well. There was no compromise on banned books, even information on contraception. Australia was one of the most censored countries in the world. It was repressive. Sexuality was not discussed. Male homosexuality and abortion was illegal since the late 1800s. Seemingly minor things like the length of boys' hair or the length of girls' skirts, you know, you just could not go beyond what the norms of society dictated. So Australia was also keen to play a part in the Cold War. This led to more repressive ideas as well. There was a race to get the nuclear bomb. The UK was actually testing bombs in Maralinga in Australia. And Australia was keen to get involved in the Vietnam War. They pushed America to get involved, actually. They said it was to protect us from the domino effect of communism, especially the China threat. In 1965, conscription was implemented, and it came along the idea of sending those conscripts into the war. This was unheard of. Young people revolted gently at first, but came up against this brick wall. The state was fixed on the status quo. Okay, so some were opting to change their world through new expression, through music or whatever. Other people did get involved in politics. Even Liberal students were keen to change things like the White Australia policy, make things easier for Aboriginal people. 1967 saw that referendum where blacks were finally regarded as human beings and were allowed to vote in federal elections. The new waves of immigrants and the pushing back of fascism in the 40s, the anti-apartheid movement, campaign for nuclear disarmament, all these things were actually growing in the 60s, 50s and 60s, really. Now, first of all, it was young civil libertarians that took a stand and looked to the law to change things. There had to be changes to legal and political structures. Okay, so the general situation, demands like equality became a pressure on the economy as equal pay and demands increased in the late 1960s for better rights for trade unionists. Trade unions, like today, there was a ban on the right to strike. So they're allowed to collectively organise, but there's also this arbitration commission, like the right to strike being banned through the legal system, the arbitration system. But things did start to change because working women had already experienced a taste of equality during the war. There had been illegal strikes during the Second World War for equal pay, which were partially successful. And after the war, even though there was a push from the state to push women back into the nuclear family after they had been able to take men's jobs while soldiers were away at war, after the war, there was a push on to get them back in the home. But this didn't work for very long. Soon there was a high demand for female labour with these labour shortages. And female labour was cheaper. At the end of the Second World War, the Labor government actually legislated through the arbitration system that women should only get 75% of the male rate of pay. At the same time, women would be suited to more women's work issues, women's work industries like textiles, clerical. By then, women were involved in teaching and nursing and also on assembly lines, machine work, which we'll talk about later. But for now, the women were part of a push for a slice of the growing economic cake and social freedoms. Basically, that's what it was about. People could see the economy was booming. They wanted their fair share. The Australian government made it clear Australia was not the home of the fair go, after all. Social freedoms were in demand. In the United States, the Kinsey Report had exposed conservative homophobic myths about sexuality, and particularly about women's sexuality. The pill became available as early as 1961 for some women. It was still restricted, but still, change was in the air. Working women faced another contradiction. They were expected to carry the burden of the unpaid labour in this nuclear family. And the state's trying to push them back into this nuclear family situation, which a lot of women wanted to be part of that, of course. But at the same time, women were being pulled into workplaces and told, well, you've got to do both. You've got to be a mother at home and you've got to have a job with pin money, less money than your male counterparts. Okay, so living a life held back by insufficient money and time, having children being expensive, they're unable to plan how many children they could have because at the same time, abortion was illegal. Contraception was inaccessible. Sometimes they were surrounded by threats and the reality of violence, especially sexual violence, sexual harassment at work, sometimes violence at home. This was part of a natural role for women, which could not be questioned, and no one talked about it. Women had the vote, but no one campaigned on these issues. And there was hardly any women in Parliament anyway. Oppression was structural. It was imposed by this social system. Many of the problems were sanctioned in law. For example, abortion was one of the open secrets of the 50s. It could have been solved by legalising and then helping to finance abortions with cheap healthcare, at least. If not, it should be free healthcare. According to Dr. Sidlecki, illegal and often barbaric abortions were the main cause of maternal death prior to the 1970s. And I've just got her report here where she said annual deaths from abortion declined from 125 in 1941 to 14 in 1970. But in the triennium, 1973 to 75, there were only two abortion deaths. And that is a measure that the kind of change that took place between the 60s and the 70s when abortion was made legal and accessible. Now, in this period as well, political situation, as David mentioned, this was all part of a general mobilisation of people in Australia. The brick wall would have to be smashed, and around the world there was a growing number of examples of how to do this. As the movement against the US war in Vietnam developed, the left in America were setting examples of struggle from the civil rights movement to the black trade unionists and the student protesters facing down armed police. And the women's liberation movement began in America and was taken up in Australia. But 1968 was the pivotal year for the left and for the working class. The Vietnam War witnessed what was called the Tet Offensive in January. This showed, it exposed that the US were losing the war. Also in 1968, French workers rose up, some taking over their workplaces and even towns. That was in May. And in August, in Prague, the USSR was stopping people fighting for their freedom against the brutal dictatorship of Stalinism. They were sending troops into Prague. So politically, anti-Stalinism for young left-wing people combined with anti-capitalism. The radicals were committed to a non-Russian Marxism, some kind of Maoism, Trotskyism, some kind of radical democracy. Many became reformists. The SDS, Students for Democratic Society, which was also imported from the US, was a kind of precursor of the new social movements. Civil rights movement inspired women, Aboriginal and anti-racism movements. Environmental movements took up. Particularly, there was the anti-war movement, which united all these groups for a common focus to get the troops out of Vietnam and stop conscription. Now, women were heavily involved. They were not only victims of a horrible system, but they were fighters for change. How did they approach these? Now, the court cases to reform abortion laws, if we take abortion as one of the most important, symbolic issues of the times, the court cases to reform the abortion laws, say in 1969 in Victoria and 1970 in New South Wales, were led by civil libertarians, women and men. And then the women's liberation movement went onto the streets to demand repeal of the laws, not just some kind of reform. The court cases only provided loopholes which made legal abortion more accessible. The courts and the politicians, the Labor Party Catholic right and the Liberals stymied any attempts. They failed again and again. So direct action tactics were devised, like rallies, protesting outside MPs' houses, and also medical and welfare activism developed to help women gain abortions and eventually women's health centres.
So in this situation, the women's liberation movement, which really emerged most strongly from 1969, what were the key demands it was raising, and was it able to develop a united strategy?
Yeah, well, there were a mixture of ideas coming from a mixture of experiences amongst women. Many women were already active in the anti-war movement, although they'd been shunted into making the tea jobs by leading men of the movement and political parties, and this angered them. The idea of calling themselves Women's Liberation came from America. Joe Freeman had a newsletter in America, and in March 1968, she said she wanted to make her newsletter the voice of the Women's Liberation Movement. That idea took off across the world. In Australia, young women like Kate Jennings famously took a stand for women activists in the anti-war movement at a 1970 rally on Sydney University's front lawn, where she said, she excoriated the young men for their hypocrisy and myopia. Go check the figures. How many Australian men have died in Vietnam and how many women have died from backyard abortions? You won't make the issue of abortion, equal pay and child minding centres because they're women's matters. This was a key debate inside the movement. Women's Liberation Meeting was advertised soon after. In Melbourne, there was a similar problem amongst activists where men didn't seem to be taking the women seriously. It's quite shocking for us today because, we're so used to being accepted, men and women, gay, straight, accepted on the left.
But not in Parliament in Canberra, apparently.
No. So it shows how little impact we've actually had in wider society.
But I think it shows that how rotten things are at the top of society, that they have some of the worst behaviour. But sorry, please go on.
People started to organise. So the first women's liberation style group was actually set up in Melbourne by a trade unionist, Zelda Di Prano. Now she set up, she's famously recorded for at the 1969 equal pay case. She was so disgusted by the lack of movement in that court case that she chained herself to the doors of the Commonwealth building. Now, I think that shows two things, that the women's movement learnt from the new left. Activists in the anti-war movement had learnt a lot of tactics like direct action from the new left, and they learnt a lot of politics, like the personal is political is actually a new left saying amongst the students. But the women's liberation movement learnt to take up these tactics of quite militant demonstrations, civil disobedience. But there are also plenty of debates about how to fight, and there were conferences. In Australia, unlike the movement in America, which was actually quite separate from the union movement in America, in Australia, the women's movement grew up with close linkages to the union movement. There was not such a difference between women and working class people at all. So the conferences were women and labour conferences to discuss, you know, how the two movements could build stronger linkages and stronger fightbacks. They started with quite strong demands, opposition to Miss World competitions and women being sex objects. They wanted an end to sexual discrimination and harassment and rape, especially within marriage. Rape was legal in marriage until the 80s in Australia. The demands also developed more deeply to questions of equal pay, free 24-hour childcare, free abortion on demand. Demands varied with the abortion. Some people were for repealing the abortion laws, and some were just for reform. Later, there was they were demanding access to jobs for women. People might have seen recently the film about the Wollongong steel industry jobs campaign, where women actually beat down BHP. That was towards the end of the 70s. Now, demands were reflecting the shift from fighting for equality within the system to radical anti-capitalist politics, but still within the political framework of the early movement. They moved from addressing systems of oppression to fighting its cause. Well, not everybody moved, but the politics actually developed. Now, obviously, you need to address the symptoms of oppression as well as the cause. But if the goal is liberation, then capitalism and its state must be identified as the enemy. Those who limited their fight to symptoms would tend to see men in their own class as the key to improving, pushing them back as the key to improving their life, a kind of individualist middle-class politics. However, many were first radicalised by the experience of inequality and harassment right in front of them. And some of them then would move on to say, but what's causing this? What is behind all this? So many younger women and trade unionists often were influenced by Marxism through the CPA. As I said before...
Sorry, the CPA being...
The Communist Party of Australia. Like I said before, that people were hostile to what the communists were, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republic, Russia, the invasion of Prague. People were hostile to what they saw as dictatorial Stalinism. However, through debates, arguments, whatever, reading, particularly amongst the students, some of the women leaders started to apply Marxism to the situation. They found out that Marx and Engels had actually been the first to theorise women's oppression, that the Russian Revolution had actually had changed the laws completely to allow women full equality, repealing all the anti-abortion laws. The state was paying for families to have free childcare, free laundries, free restaurants. Now, Zelda Di Prano had been in the Communist Party, but she'd got nothing but grief from them. So she committed herself to some of the basic ideas of the early Communist Party, these ideas from the Russian Revolution, but rejected what she saw in front of her.
So you say that the intersection and involvement of the women's movement and the workers' movement was much, much closer here than it was, for instance, in the United States, where the two things operated quite separately from each other. In what way was the women's liberation movement here more of a working class movement? What's the evidence for that?
Okay, well, when you think about it, the majority of women are part of the working class. And from the 60s, women were entering workplaces, particularly into white collar industries. The capitalist women, the CEOs of the world, did not give a damn about the rights on the job if it affected their profits. So working women and professional women joined unions in large numbers. This was encouraged by the left. The left helped bring about the women's movement anyway. And so women workers were part of the enormous strike movement that emerged after the right to strike was won. In May 1969, a unionist was jailed, and there was a general strike in response to that, which made the anti-strike laws a dead letter, actually. After that, after a million workers just walking off the job, the government couldn't use the anti-strike laws anymore. So that was in mid-May 69. Some women were already fighting inside the metalworkers' unions at that stage, and in meat workers, in the abattoirs, butchers. School teachers were fighting for equal pay by then, alongside other unions, and the militancy amongst all these workers was rising from 67. In 68, there were mass strikes in the metal industry, and strike figures just kept rising beyond the 69 situation. See, the women's movement was developing in the midst of all this. I've got this little story. In 1969, in the Supreme Court of Victoria, in mid-May, Clary O'Shea was being sentenced to jail as the leader of this union movement. At the same time, the abortion legislation was being amended, or there was a court case over the abortion legislation. The Menhinnitt Agreement came out of that. So you can see how all these issues were happening all at the same time. Some unions took up women's demands, particularly equal pay, and often workers were striking for the first time ever. There were women workers in the insurance and the bank workers, the retail and hospitality industries. And even if they didn't work themselves in these militant areas, the generalised struggle built confidence across the class. So that helped to build the support for anti-war movement, the Medibank campaigns. Medibank was the Medicare issue today. But building workers in particular are a good example of how they built strong unions during this period. They went from casual to permanent workers. They fought for other workers' rights. They fought for jobs in the industry for women. And once women were in the jobs, they actually fought for and won paid leave for women who needed to have abortions. Now, some of the workers in the building industry opposed some of these things, particularly equal pay, because, well, they thought equal pay would damage them. But the union leaders who were in the Communist Party and part of the left said, well, we're going to fight for equal pay so that all workers are paid the same. And then we all go out together and those women will support us as we support them. And that's how they won equal pay in the building industry. Only recently have we started to talk about having leave for miscarriages, but the building industry unions had actually discussed that and some of them had carried the day. So solidarity across the working class was important, but so was political leadership. And the women were part of all this by this stage.
Now, you mentioned the role, for instance, of the Communist Party there, and obviously the left, and in those days the Communist Party was easily the largest group to the left of Labour, and the left of Labour was much more left-wing than it is today. So the left, in the broad sense, was important because of its leadership role in the working class movement, but it also had to learn a lot as well, because it sometimes had quite poor track records when it came to women members. You mentioned Zelda Toprano. I read her autobiography recently. She was treated the most horrible, patronising way by Communist Party officials. And the former Communist Party activist, the late Amira Inglis, wrote her autobiography entitled it The Hammer and Sickle and the Washing Up. So clearly the left, and I'm talking primarily, if you like, the Social Democratic and Communist Party left, could contribute but had a lot to learn. How did that dynamic work its way through?
Well, the women had to stand up to their male counterparts, but they also had allies amongst some men who did agree with the idea of women's liberation. Zella De Prano's experience was similar to a lot of women in political parties on the left. They were given jobs that didn't seem very important, like the fundraising and the tea making, etc. And they were told that when they complained, that women's issues weren't central to the fight today for socialism. Now, that's totally anathema. It's different from what we would consider today. We think the fight against sexual harassment, the fight against all these symptoms of oppression, are necessary in order to fight for socialism. But the Communist Party told their women members, the Stalinist Communist Party told their women members that liberation could only come after they supported a socialist revolution.
So how much did the women's liberation movement shape the working class struggle, and how much did the working class struggle shape the women's liberation movement? How much was learnt from the collective experience?
Okay, like I've said, that at first there was confusion and hostility between male and female activists. There's the Zelda De Prano experience. But as early as 69, there were left-wing Communist Party activists and some trade union leaders welcoming the struggles by women and recognising women's involvement in the workplaces. Equal pay was important to men and women workers. And the equal pay strikes among the metalworker women in 69 were really supported well. People were suspicious of white-collar workers at first, and women dominated in a lot of white-collar industries. But white-collar workers joined the unions in large numbers, and in their fights for equal pay and for better conditions and higher pay, because they were fairly low paid in often situations, say insurance work and bank workers, their fights actually were an example to be followed by other unionists. Winning equal pay through industrial action was an inspiration for other workers. But also there was unity over particular demands, like in the anti-war struggles, in the campaign for Medibank. There's a layer of younger militant activists started joining in the unions, and you'd have to say that the women's liberation movement played a role in pushing these women forward, building their confidence. So by the late 70s, public service unions, which were traditionally run by right-wing Catholic, Labor Party, trade union officials, started to see reform groups building up inside them. And a lot of women were involved in that. So in Victoria, there was the Victorian Public Service Reform Group in the Federal Public Service. And this idea of changing the unions spread in the late 70s and early 80s across the public service. So men and women saw that they were allies in the fight, and this both built stronger militancy, stronger unity, but also respect between men and women, that they were part of the same union, part of the same struggle. And the struggle itself was very much strengthened by that. There are lots of stories about the men starting to recognise that women could also be great on the picket lines, and the women starting to see that men didn't need to be someone who was going to harass you. These differences and were overcome in the course of the struggle. So the women's movement was part of that. It's not the only thing. The fact that the women's movement was linked to the union movement and the militancy came through the fights, the generalised struggle against the war and, you know, around other issues at the time. Anti-racism is another one in particular.
It seems in some ways to me that there was a huge amount of gains out of these struggles in the 60s and 70s, and yet we're still fighting many of those battles now. The report that's just come out about the level of bullying, sexual harassment and outright sexual assault in Parliament House, for instance, I think really underlines the extent to which there is something rotten inside our current society. We still haven't seen the winning of effective equal pay, formal equal pay, but not effective equal pay. There are still too few women in leadership positions, although obviously that has shifted substantially in the union movement, but there's still a long way to go. So looking back on that period of the 60s and 70s, and I realise we've only scratched the surface of what is an incredibly deep and rich history, what can we learn to take the struggle forward today?
Well, I think we do have to maintain a fight against every example of sexism that we come across. So we have to fight the symptoms, but we have to recognise that those symptoms have a cause, and it's the way capitalism is organised. The cause, origins and maintenance of oppression, we have to keep in mind that capitalism benefits and is strengthened by the fact that women are pushed into a role in the family to give birth to children and look after young children initially. Now, families have changed. The nuclear family is not like it was. We've got same-sex marriage. But I think one of the core things that the ruling class forces people to do unpaid labour for is to actually have the children and feed them in the early days. So the nuclear family structure sets the example for what a woman's role is, to be mothers. Of course, they need women in the factories as well, in the workplaces. In particular, women are the majority in a lot of the low-paid essential industries we see today. This was exposed during the pandemic. So in challenging the symptoms of sexual harassment, in challenging the symptoms of the way women are treated in the workplace, if we can link that to the kind of things the women's liberation movement was fighting for actually in the early days, which was free 24-hour childcare, sexual liberation and equal pay, challenging the system, then that will help to build a stronger struggle which challenges institutions like the family and segregated industries, pro-family tax benefits, homophobia and transphobia, etc. All those things are a product of a system which says that the system actually needs free labour to produce the next generation of workers. If the left in Australia was slow to challenge manifestations of sexism in the early days for women and slow to challenge the racism against Aboriginal people and gay people, it's not the case today. We're fortunate that oppressed people have fought back so militantly. It's left a mark on our history that oppression is unacceptable. But we have to recognise that the state should be providing and paying for more services to support struggling families. Family violence cannot be solved by police. The Black Lives Matter protests have demanded an ending to oppressive policing. It's better to establish more services for families to cope with heavy childcare loads, better to pay higher equal wages to solve income and financial issues, challenge the system. The problem we have, though, is that capitalism is not going to deal with this easily. They're not going to foot the bill. Capitalism cannot foot the bill, actually. The capitalist system is going into crisis. So it's not just a question of money and services either. The capitalist state is not set up for human need. It must be destroyed. It must be replaced by working people who can then decide on how a new society can best be organised. Now, that was tried actually in the Russian Revolution back in 1917. It didn't last long because of the Stalinist counter-revolution. But what needs to happen today is to build a movement for change based on the needs of today's working class women and men, oppressed people, active unionists fighting for their rights across the world. Even in the United States, we are seeing a new strike wave in essential workplaces and spreading into amongst engineering workers, where women and people of many backgrounds, oppressed in many ways, are showing that they are the fighters for change. So they're showing that capitalism needs them to provide the profits for a growing system. If the system's going to grow, it needs the profits. But that gives the power to those workers. So if they're united, they can stop the growth of the system, put pressure on the system to make the demands that we want a different system. We've seen the Black Lives Matter protests and the women's strikes spread across the world, showing how examples of alternative ways to manage our lives and how to start a struggle for change. Now, it's true that Australia's running behind, but I've been on the picket line recently at Country Road, or Country Rogues, we're now calling them. Those women actually just won an improvement in their working lives, so they've now got 75% permanency, whereas there are more casuals before the strike. They've won good wage rise and they've won other improvements. So, and there's been a series of strikes in that area down in Truganina in Melbourne. So even in Australia, where women workers and also the New South Wales teachers, nurses and paramedics have been among the leading activists fighting for change in their workplaces, those workplace struggles need to be linked with a broader struggle for change. What the 70s has shown us, that if those struggles can link up together, they can be stronger. They can hit the bosses with a united punch. They have to fight back on the anti-strike laws, but they can do that by taking united strike action. But that needs to link in with the wider struggles, like the Black Lives Matter, like the anti-racism struggles we've seen. And in that way, we can actually see a movement build that can actually change capitalism once and for all.
Thank you. That's really inspiring. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. That was great.